Let me identify, just for the record, my name is Lou Smith. I'm a campus pastor at the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire. And every semester in our campus ministry operation, we sponsor two, sometimes three groups that get called grief and loss support groups. And so when Shuni came along and said, there's a topic we ought to talk about, plugged into some items that I'm a little bit familiar with at least, I'm going to take it as my task during the course of the evening to sort of moderate the conversation, that is to say, to see how well I can do at giving everybody who wants a chance to get in and be heard to have that chance to do so. And Shuni Hartwig, who's next to me here, and Roger Harms are going to function as sort of our kickoff persons to say a few things to get the conversation rolling. But I think we want you to know that we count it as your conversation and hope that you'll be able to make use of it. What we asked Roger to do was to get things started for us by talking a little bit about some of the physical aspects of grief. We move very quickly to the emotions and the feeling side of things, but it seems pretty clear that grief is also, we don't break people up quite so easily into bodies and emotions and so on and compartmentalize. So we've asked Roger if he would say something to start us off about some of the physical aspects of grieving, and when he's done, Shuni's going to jump right in and go, and that ought to put the ball out in play someplace. So please.
Okay. Well, my name is Roger Harms, and I'm sort of a short-legged kickoff man on this particular team because, as an obstetrician gynecologist, I thankfully have not had probably as much experience with grief and loss as other physicians have, but I do play a role in Rochester in the perinatal death support group for parents who have lost children either stillbirth or early in the baby's life, and so I do have some contact with the field. In regard to physiologic bodily responses to grief, there's a little bit of variation that depends upon how suddenly the grief appears. The more sudden and the more shocking the loss is, the more dramatic, I guess you could say, the physiologic initial response is. The body is sort of on a tight string, if you will, at all times, physiologically being prepared to act in what we call in medicine the fight or flight mechanism, where the body systems have capability of shifting the blood flow away from what's considered non-vital organs like the skin to organs that would be required in the case of fight or flight, such as the muscles, the brain, the heart, etc. And in the shocking announcement of a moment of loss to a person, usually that mechanism comes into play. And without the extension then of physical exercise, despite the body's reaction as such, there's a fair number of stresses on the body that result in elevation in blood pressure, rapid heart rate, and if one was predisposed to cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, for instance, at a moment of stress like that, it could happen. This, of course, the degree of response is generally related to the shock and the unexpectedness of the loss. However, even if the loss is expected, there can, in the grieving process and the healing process that follows, there are certainly a lot of physiologic reactions. No matter what the cause of depression, generally the patient experiences a poverty of motion, an inability to do things, and a general feeling of weakness and malaise that is real and is related just to probably the helplessness that they feel. In addition, the rest of the body responds to this, and it's very common for people to have headache difficulties. Tension headaches, of course, would be very common in this area. Diarrhea is something that happens in many people as a result of emotional upheaval, and that's not uncommon at the time of grieving. And other relatively minor but disturbing symptoms can arise. And finally, for reasons that we don't particularly understand, we don't understand well at all, at times of major stress, like the loss of a loved one, all human beings seem to be more prone to disease, serious disease. And indeed, after the loss of a loved one, your chances of dying in the next 12 months from any, the most common diseases being, depending on your age group, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and accidents, all three varieties of death are elevated in the next 12 to 24 months after a major loss. We don't very well understand why this happens. Accidents may very well be related to mental lapses or going to chemical means of soothing the loss. But as far as cardiovascular disease and the onset of other serious internal diseases like cancer, we don't really understand how the grieving process can affect the body's mechanisms. I guess as a kickoff, I just say that the body is certainly affected physiologically as well as emotionally, and that can be very profound in a grieving person and is part of what has to be dealt with a loss.
Seemed to me that this would be a good introduction for us to at least have some kind of an understanding, because no matter who you are in this room, whether you're in your early 20s or you're an older parent or have an aging parent, if you have not experienced knowing someone up to this point in your life who has suffered the loss of someone, and you have not yourself, you most certainly will. And it is a path that most of us have no charting for. So that if you yourself are catapulted suddenly, as I was one evening by a doorbell to announce the death of my son, that he had left very healthily 5 hours earlier and had been in a car accident, was 16 years old, to know that all of a sudden there is a new world and there is no preparation for it. You don't understand your body, and everything is turned literally upside down. You don't understand the relationships, you don't understand much of anything. If any of you have had any experience in this, I am speaking common language to you. So I thought what would be provocative, hopefully, for our discussion and helpful to one another is to perhaps explain some of those paths, some of us who have been on them, or some of you who have been able to stretch your arms to others on that path, to share some of the things that you feel have really helped. Because there are different roles, and those of us who are grieving are in one, and we have expectations of you who are in the other. Now, when I lost my son, I had expectations that suddenly came, and mine aren't going to be yours. So we have to say that what happens for me is not going to be necessarily for you. And so in our conversation, we have to understand that we are so individual in how we grieve. There is no pattern. And there's nothing that makes a grieving person usually more angry is someone to tell them how they felt, right? Just doesn't work. No one wants to be a recipe because you are just too individual. It was your loss, and that is so personal. You do not want anybody to make it theirs. All right, so I thought that it might be helpful if we would take different people for whom we look to in expectation that you are going to help. You're going to try and make some sense out of this world of mine that is torn apart. And I'll leave some of the hard ones to last. And let me tell you some that I would like to discuss. The first one is a friend, and that doesn't make any difference what your age is. I'd like to talk about friendship. I would like to talk, so we're talking about then those of us who are grieving and those of you who are friends, and what we don't know for sure what we want you to do, but we know we want you to do something, right? Okay, I'd like to talk about family members, whether it's your parent, and that will change obviously depending on what the loss is. And of course now we are talking, I stated death loss, but it goes for any loss, whether it's a divorce, anything that separates and is a breaking apart of a relationship. All right, church, pastors, God, and you, the person who's grieving. All right, does that help? Okay, so let's start out with the beginning part because that's the easiest. Those of us who are grieving, we're numb. We're in no man's land. And I don't know what you call it, but I guess that there's this shock stage that we're in. And for everybody, it lasts different times. And for many of us within church communities, and clearly most of us here are that is the time when everybody comes to the house. Okay? And if you dare to go to the house, depends on how you feel about the people who are grieving. Because that puts you on really uneasy turf, right? Am I going to say the right thing? And I would just like to give my suggestion now. Keep your mouth shut and your arms open. And if there's anybody that would like to add that, I could write a book, and if we, you know, people who have grieved could write a hilarious book. I mean, if there's anything that's funny, if you want to try and find humor in the situation, it's what people say. You just wouldn't believe it unless you've been there. One lady brought me these rolls, and she looked at me and she handed me the roll. She says, you know, death is so final. I said, yeah, what are you supposed to say? Or the insurance salesman who comes and says, you know, your life is going to be dramatically changed. Yeah, I mean, it's profound, you know. And so, I mean, those are really kind of nice things that I'm saying. I leave the others. But there are things, you know, it's very important for your presence because we are agonizing in the missing. And if you touch me, it will mean much more than anything your mouth is going to say. If you give me pious platitudes like Jesus is going to wipe your tears away, time heals grief, I'm going to sock you, maybe. Right? And just, you know, it's somehow we want to verbalize and make it better. I mean, that's just a human condition. You know, we really feel like if we could just say the right thing. And usually we are not gifted with words. And I think that the people, anyway, in my experience, when I was grieving, and I've had two experiences, I've also lost my husband, so that your ears are, you have new antennas. It's like a blind person who suddenly hears. And those of us who are grieving, have you ever had the experience that usually the grieving person is one that comforts you? Many times happens. And it's my experience anyway that we are so tuned into your uneasiness that we really want to make you feel better because we feel so bad already. We really don't need to have you come and make us feel worse, you know? So anyway, let me just, I like to tell you about a friend. One friend. And this is someone I never knew. And she is a pastor's wife, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in the same church as Jenny and Daryl Nelson, as a matter of fact. And I have a sister-in-law who lives in the same church, my husband's oldest sister. My husband died very suddenly from a heart attack. And when that news went to Sioux Falls, it hit that congregation as it does. It ripples, right? It's not just the immediate family, it's everybody. And for Norma Jean, this was really something for her, because she too had grieved. And as all of you know, when you have grieved and someone you care for loses, it recycles for you. It's like taking a Band-Aid off an ulcer, isn't it? You think, you kind of ease some of those sores, and time has eased a bit of the pain. But when someone else is grieving, if there's any parallel at all to what you experienced, you are just erupted many times yourself. Well, Norma Jean, when she was at Augsburg, lost a brother to leukemia. And 2 years later, her father died from leukemia. All right? And my experience, she didn't know me. She'd met me once. Somehow recycled. And I started getting these little postcards in the mail with calligraphied verses on. They wouldn't always be scriptural. They would be a saying, I wish I should have brought some, because I brought some along. Sometimes they were, one was the Isaiah, I call you by name. All right? And I thought, first, there's no name. I thought it was my sister-in-law, because all I could see was the postmark and it said Sioux Falls. And come to find out, this was Norma Jean. My husband died, it'll be 3 years in October, and I periodically, in fact, before I came to Holden, because she was concerned about me coming here by myself, I got a card. Now that is stretching your arms. There is no way that, she now is my soul sister. I find time every time I go to Sioux Falls. She and I have a very special bond. I have a sister-in-law who, for the first year and a half after my son's death, called regularly. And I do mean regularly. And at that time, I was in North Carolina, so it was a long-distance call. She has called me weekly since my husband's death.
Still.
And that is really reaching. Because, you see, my friends, we don't just grieve the first week, and we don't just grieve the second week. We're never going to be the same people. And we do want to remember, but we need your arms to help us keep walking upright. And there are some ways that you can do that. So, now, friends, anybody have an experience that it has really helped you, that might help someone here beyond, that might be of use sometime in the future? Okay, Rob?
I can really relate to what you're saying, just there with Norma Jean. My father died 3 years ago, similarly, my freshman year of school, of a heart attack. So, and the thing that it's really kind of difficult for me now, 3 years down the line, is that I want people to know that. You kind of have a selfish feeling that, listen to me and what I have to say and what I've lost. And it's not wanting pity as such, but kind of a desire to tell people and let that be known and let that not be standing in the way of some relationship. I find it's one of the first things I want to let someone know when we get to know, just because, there are too many awkward situations where they talk about your parents or your father's day coming up, a yearly reminder there, their birthday, this and that. And for me, if there's one thing I'd want to say, it would be for that person not to feel uneasy by making that mistake about, your parents, my dad died, and then they just feel, they're flushed or whatever, and they feel really bad, and that's not my purpose at all by telling them. Actually, it's my reason for telling them or letting them know is just that, maybe I think enough about them that I want them to know that about me, because that's such a big part of my life and my future. And so you don't have that little bridge in the way anymore to have to cross over. So that's a kind of uneasy feeling in me still, because in some ways you want other people to recognize that you may still be grieving. I get I get a lot of that, the arms, from my family, the rest, you know, brothers and sisters who will remember to maybe drop a card on a couple cards during that week, the anniversaries thereof or whatever. And, you know, if other people would think of that too, it's really a real benefit, a real gift. One other thing I wanted to mention too is what you were saying about how the grief become the comforters. And that was really my experience also. At the wake that we had, my dad was a pastor for 25 years, and so he was very well known in the town that we lived and everything. And the wake was just a beautiful thing. Open 4 hours, I think it was, and just huge lines of people, you know, coming to pay their last respects or whatever. And there the whole family was, six of us, whatever you call it, a reception line, which is, the whole thing's kind of odd. You go through a lot of odd things that you never thought about, like shopping for a casket, you know, walking through, picking out a casket and looking at different, you can get gold plated ones and this and that, and picking out cemetery plots, all those things that you don't think of beforehand. But anyway, this, at the wake, you know, to be up there and have these people come through. And many of them, of course, didn't know what to say or how to say it or anything. Others would just come up and start sobbing or wailing, I guess is the word, you know. And we're up there, you know, it's okay, we'll do okay. My mom was a dry eye throughout the entire afternoon, and it just blew most of us away. You know, you didn't know what to make of it. And some people were just losing it. But any advice, I guess, on my part would be, to be there, that is the thing. I mean, to show up and to be physical too. Yeah, like you say, to hug, to touch the person, you know, makes all the difference in the world. And then the continued presence, you know, to make yourself available to that person. Not to avoid it because of your uncertainty as to what you should say or what you should do or what you should bring. That stuff doesn't matter at all. Just, you know, go ahead and shut up and just be there and touch or whatever. And that was the experience that I had with friends, you know, who would just hang around and see what they could do with me or for me or something like that.
You brought up one thing that, as friends, and you said talking when someone, you want to tell them. And that is part of our life. There is no way, there was a woman here last week whose youngest child had drowned two years ago. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, she said, and I said, what do you do when someone comes up? If you're a woman and you are my age, one of the first questions someone says to you, how many children do you have? And that is a real hard hurdle if you've ever lost a child, because you have to make some split second decisions in those early year months. Do you say four, which was my total family, or do I say three? And because then you don't know what they're going to say after that. You see, if you say four, some people are going to say, oh. But then someone else might say, well, you know, well, tell me about them, right? Now, depending on who that person is, if you've never met them before, you may be up to saying that. You may feel on that day that that's something you want to. Or then on another day that there's just no way to wipe you out, and the person doesn't know you that way, and there you are deluged, and they're saying, my goodness, you know, all I said was, how many children do you have? So that as a friend, which is just pointing up the fact that we have really been culturally moved in such a way, in so many ways, to deny death. And so one way we deny that it's happened is we deny the existence of the person so that the person drops out. So that if you are my friend and you did know Carl, my son, I would love to talk to you sometimes about Carl. If you knew Jerry, my husband, there are times I would love for you to remind me of something, conversation. I remember the time that we did this, and it was the craziest thing, or whatever. Not to say, you know, that you come up and say, now today would you like to talk about so-and-so? Not that. That's not what I'm saying. But we want to remember, and we don't want you to forget. Because if you forget, then that means that the existence of those who we loved, who are no longer a part of us now, is being forgotten. That is death. Yes?
This is a question, not a solution.
Yeah.
But in the case of a person that has lost a loved one, a married person, and has remarried, how then do you discuss the situation in light of considering the person that has now married you? Does this in some way create any problems between your past marriage and the present marriage?
Well, now I'm not on that path. So if there's anyone here who, I know of people for whom that, and perhaps Lou, you or someone else can speak to that, for whom if, well, I'll just conjecture that daring to love again, in other words, to remarry, or in this case, would, is many times very fruitful, wonderful happening. It is also very often a panacea for loneliness and can be a real problem, especially if the grief is not resolved. And I don't know quite how to say it. For me, I'm a circle person. These being Indians and third world, I've lived abroad in Tanzania, so and they have a saying there that there are those who go before, those who are here right now, and those who are yet to be. Now, to me, that's a circle. Now, my circle may change, but it doesn't diminish. So, say I do meet someone that I will dare to love again. Notice I said dare, because if I love, it means I might lose. That my circle is not changed. I still will always, there's going to be a part of me that was still, I bore a child. He is no longer part of this earth in physical way, but he is part of who I am. I also married someone with whom I lived for 23 years, so that is part of who I am. But that's not to say I have to stay the same. My circle can increase, but with death, it does not, for me, diminish. And that, to me, is spirit living. So that if you can, and clearly there are people for whom that is very possible, that you can continue in life and you can add on relationships, but you are not denying those who have been a part of making who you are. We do not live with people for 23 years or 10 years or 5 years and all of a sudden just go, and they are no longer there, because if you did live with them and there was any kind of interaction of any meaning, they have had a real tremendous impact on you.
I think maybe my question wasn't placed very well.
Okay.
I was thinking more on the lines of if I were to approach a person who has lost a husband but has since remarried, would I, for example, say, I remember the time that you and your husband did such and such, and this is in front of the new husband. Does this create some kind of problem for the two of them? Or for the new husband and wife combination?
My father-in-law died before I met my husband. My mother-in-law is not remarried, but she has a steady male friend that, you know, is often around when we visit. And I've noticed that she really likes to talk about Myron, my husband's father, but she never talks about it in front of this friend. Or if she does, very seldom and very briefly she talks about it. And I've noticed it seems like she really likes to talk about when the kids were young and when he was alive and when they were first married and tell us stories about that, or tell me stories about it because I haven't heard him. Or remind my husband of things that happened when the kids were little and stuff. But she doesn't do that when he's around. And even when she'll mention his name or anything, she keeps her comments really concise. And so I think she enjoys talking about him, but her way of dealing with that is to not do it when he's around. Because I think for them that's uncomfortable, or for him that's uncomfortable. I'm sure different people are different, but I have noticed that she really does like to talk about him, but not when his male friend is around.
I feel I have kind of a healthy way. I think some people think I'm a little off sometimes, but my husband, I put his ashes 4 years ago in the river where him and the boy has always fished. And it's only about, not too far from where I live. So I go there quite often, and I stand there by the bridge and I talk to it. Or when my boy will say, do you want to go down and talk to Herbie? He always calls his dad or Herbie. And we get down and we yak by the bridge, you know. So the minister said to me one day, he said, what do you say to him? I said, damn you for leaving me.
That's right.
And he said, you were after him when he was alive and you're still after him. I feel good about it. I feel good when I go there, maybe once a month.
I just want to respond because to record a really drastically different experience from yours. I think one of the, I would even go so far as to say that the best marriage that I've ever been involved in as a pastor was a marriage of a woman whose first husband had died probably 8 years prior to this second marriage, and in all of the preparation and everything that went on, there was a lot of conversation about how her former husband was really, you know, still significant to her, and that she was just not simply going to drop this off somehow, and that her current husband would deal with that. And the man and the woman both have really had no difficulty with that. I suspect probably because they really put it up front right away and didn't play sort of suspicion games, but they. Wayne is a part of the conversation as it goes on all the time, and is just as liable to be an extensive subject of conversation when any of us are together as anybody else who happens.
Mm-hmm. I think my mother-in-law, I forget that she's uncomfortable that things go that way, but I think that we as friends or people around have to be sensitive to where the couple is at. And if they kind of have an understanding that we don't talk about the ex-husband or wife, then we as friends should respect that. But if they're open about it, and I think that you can kind of pick up on it, because it didn't take me long to know that I don't talk about my husband's father when this other gentleman is around.
And I think it's not so much a denial when that one other person's around, but it's kind of like there's a fine line. We don't want to dwell in the past because there's a future here with this new relationship. So I think there seems to be kind of a fine line. But I know a couple different second marriages, and in both cases, both had families before, and they both had children. It would be crazy to deny that or to forget about it. And I think there's a lot of sharing that goes on with those experiences that they both went through. And in both of these cases, the spouse died through an accident or cancer. A heart attack, and I think there's a sharing of, and we both have gone through those things before.
In a selfish sort of way, though, I'm tentative about this whole thing that I have an uncle who died of cancer, and my aunt remarried within a year, and was seeing this guy within 3 or 4 months afterwards, and I'm really excited about that, and happy that that's all working out, but at the same time, I haven't heard her talk about how he sensed. And I don't want to forget my uncle, because he meant a lot to me, and I did a lot with him, and things like that. And in a selfish way, I don't even get to enjoy his life anymore with her. And I can with her kids, but I'm worried about her, which isn't a good thing to be, because, like you said, it's an individual grieving thing. But for her to swarm herself with someone else right away, and maybe not to allow herself to feel the same, which is nothing I have control over or anything like that, but I'm saying what another hurt that is. in a selfish sort of way, that we can't rejoice in his life anymore, things that he did and the things we did together. And for any potential, you know, if you ever get yourself in that kind of situation, go ahead. That would be a goal of mine, is to be receptive as possible to talking, because that is, it's such a major part. You can't do it 25 years spent together beforehand or something like that. And it's such a major part, and I wonder what kind of relationship you can really have ignoring all of that, because I would think that so much of a spouse's life and being, that whatever the basis the relationship has, maybe is then kind of a weak threat. And it's different than you can do.
How did your cousins feel?
They wanted to talk about it, and I don't think they had a chance to around the house, because she all of a sudden was their age dating, you know, and that kind of thing. And that was really hard for them, and I think they had a real need and want to talk about it, and they were able to find that in our family also, because this is after my dad had died, so we could equate the two, yet my mom wasn't at the same stage of life as their mom, so it was a really tricky thing, and I think they felt...
Yeah, because I would guess the children would feel like they were sort of being ignored or, well, obviously, or denied in a way, because it's like spouse is denied. That's, you know, their father or their mother. That would be strange.
We also kind of say of grief, sadly, for one loss or two losses, loss of someone through death. I think, too, of a grieving loss of a job. An opportunity. Relocating can be a tremendous grieving experience. I'm a family marriage counselor in Sacramento, and I see a lot of people, divorce people, who after a divorce go through a tremendous grieving period in which they grieve loss of self-esteem. It's a huge loss, which means loss of trust. When you lose self-esteem, you lose trust. One follows the other. So I think you can grieve the loss of anything important to you. When Aldrin got to the moon, Buzz Aldrin got to the moon, and he came back down again. I mean, where do you go from the moon? You know, after years of striving for that goal, and the loss of that goal meant, I think, for him a tremendous feeling experience. As with Nixon, loss of power, and his phlebitis, I think, was a direct result, his illness. Direct result of loss of power overnight, which almost took his life. So I like to expand grieving beyond just the. There are thousands of different kinds of deaths, not just physical deaths. Different types. Loss of health, of an arm or a leg. It's just endless. And all losses, I think, have feelings in common and stages in common.
I'd like to take off on that. Also, I've experienced a number of the losses in which you're talking about, and I have found it especially helpful to me to talk about it with people. And as Rolf said, almost right off the bat, or when it's comfortable, or when the relationship warrants it. Because then that person knows where I'm at, what makes up my life. And also I found that it's a giving process too, because maybe they've been in that spot and don't know what to do, or they're going through that right now. And it has helped me tremendously to deal with my own grief and change, to help someone else go through that also. And then it becomes a sharing process. And a real bond is created that's not created through any other way. And I'm really, with Rolf and Michelle, and over here, I believe that kind of talking of any kind of grief like that is just really important. And as far as relationships go, I have felt that being right up front with those feelings, with, let's say, from a divorce or a death to, let's say, it's a divorce and you're getting involved with someone else, letting them know where you're at. You know, it's nothing I don't feel that should be hidden or covered up or put in a corner. It should be upfront and open. If that person can't deal with it, then it's something the two of you need to deal with together.
I think related to this, every day here at Golden Village, there's an opportunity to practice our grief. And it's really a beautiful thing. For me, I've lived here 2 years, and every day the bus leaves and takes away someone. And some days it's really hard because someone's leaving that I care about. Another day, maybe it's not someone I care about, but somebody Rolf cares about. And I can be there to hug Rolf, and the next day maybe he'll be there to hug me. And it happens day in and day out around here, and it's just a neat, wonderful, you know, community thing. And what you said about being there, you know, so many times a week, I just hate them. And I think, I don't even know these people that well. What do I go there for? But to hear you say, just to be there and touch or whatever, I can do that. But we can practice right here every day.
In regard to having a grief situation after death, I'd like to relate to connection to my wife's question. We had decided a long time prior to the fact we knew she was terminally ill that there was not going to be a grave. There was not going to be just going to be cremation. Our kids were scared, and there was no one central place at which you could have a marker or a grave or anything for whatever purpose. So if it was from the body, it was going to be cremated, and we would simply have a memorial service. Well, as it so happened, why she found that she had been three died in about a year. So at the time of the funeral, at the time of the memorial service, the emphasis was one of joy, as far as I was concerned. Joy because she is now relieved of her pain, her illness. Medical science hadn't been introduced to her yet. She was with me. She had to be infinitely happier than I was. Why should one grieve? And that memorial service was a real celebration. And some of the the church was good. And everybody came around to talk about Dorothy, which was fine. But she had a healing. So that may be a hardened position on mine, but I didn't really have a serious grief, so I lost the gap in my life. She's happy. She's better off than I am. So that's something to be happy about. Period.
I had an interesting experience a couple years ago. I came home at Christmas time for Christmas break, and my parents sat all this down, and they said, well, we're writing up a new will, and we're trying to figure out what should be done with our bodies when we die. And we all, I've got five brothers and sisters, and we all sat down at the table and we started discussing this. And it just kind of blew me away. It was, I know my parents, you know, talk about death, and it's, you know, it's not this big, scary thing to them. But it was just really a good experience to have to sit down and confront your family and say what your feelings are, whether you got cremated or whether someone else in your family got cremated or got had parts like eyes donated to science or the body got donated to science. And I was surprised that it scared me as much as it did. I always thought that, well, I know I can handle that. It's a healthy thing. I mean, it's part of life, you know. And I think that's one thing that's really important is to deal with it before it gets to you. I don't know how I'll respond when my parents do die, but I'm really glad that we've already talked about our feelings. And my parents said, you know, well, okay, if you really would just feel awful, if you, at this point you think you'd feel awful if you got cremated, we won't do that. But how do you feel? And I just think that's something that people should think about, you know, for their kids or their families or their grandparents, whoever.
Yeah, that's really helping prepare you. Yes. You'll find that out. Some questions you won't have to answer. And that will be good.
In some ways, it may be helpful to talk about, if anyone knows, grieving processes that didn't succeed in healing. I personally was very closely involved in one of those, where the person who was the primary sufferer of loss did not succeed, really, in healing. Did not succeed in continuing on with life, getting back into the mainstream of life. And it's difficult, having been close in on the situation, to analyze it, but some of the things that you people who've obviously been more successful in handling it, that you point out, such as the touching and the hugging in my family, you know, that was, I don't know whether it was a German Lutheran throwback or something, but hugging was just something nobody did in our family. I mean, I think to hear the words, "I love you," in our house was probably once every 5-6 years, something like that. You just weren't emotional. You just didn't express things out on the cuff. Maybe felt them very deeply, but you didn't express them. And when I was 10 years old, my father died. And so, in a way, from a childhood point of view, it's interesting. I don't think I can reflect much on the grief process when you're an adult, because it was different for me. I didn't really want a bunch of strange women from the church hugging me. That's 10-year-old boy outlook. But on the other hand, they were more likely to hug me than to hug my mother. And she may have been the one who needed it. Because all of a sudden she was tossed into a new situation, and there was the offer of help there, but usually it started out with, "Well, Annie, you know, we've got to get the funeral arrangements done. We'll help you. We'll take you there," and all this kind of stuff. But it was very businesslike, like the Harms family has always been. You know, this is the next thing that's to be done. And the house has to be cleaned. People came in to help clean the house. The house got lots of attention. And the other thing was, food was prepared in great and wonderful amounts. But like I said, I don't know that anybody hugged my mother, except maybe me, and I was just doing it out of me needing support rather than trying to support her. So that is obviously not the whole story in terms of why my mom, I would call, essentially failed in getting through a grieving process. But I think it played a role, and it sort of reflects positively on you people who got good experiences from what your friends did in terms of sharing the healing power of touch. Because there is no words that help. So sitting around the living room and talking didn't seem to do the trick.
Well, church can be very painful, no matter what your loss is. And it's painful for many reasons. And it ties up with what you expect, speaking of expectations, for God's role in your life. And it also ties in with remembering. And I guess I'd just like to throw that out just kind of quickly, because I see our time is going. Because that's one time, I think, when you expect us to really have it together. I mean, after all, that is where the sustenance of our faith is. That is the center of our community. And I don't know when this is going to change for me. I hope it will. Maybe it won't. But communion for me is still an agonizing experience, because it's that very harsh reminder of absence of presence and the communion of saints. And those of you who have lost will amen with me, I'm sure. All of a sudden you will look at the liturgy differently. You will hear all the angels and the hosts of heaven. and that says something new to you. I have a very difficult time singing Children of the Heavenly Father. There is a verse in A Mighty Fortress that I don't sing. Take kindred spouse, okay? All right. And I'm not alone. There is a hymn for everybody for whom there was an expectation that that was going to be your sustenance, and all of a sudden you come to it and it wipes you out. Because either it's a reminder of absence or you are still dealing with stumbling through life, whatever is happening to you. And when I was in North Carolina, at the time of my son's death, we were members of a predominantly black Lutheran church. 75 on a Sunday was a big day. Small. And one reason, if there has been any healing that's taken place in my life, it is because of that family, for whom an understanding for many of life and death is more daily, in daily experiences of expectations that are never met, of opportunities that never happen, of doors that never seem to open. And there was a silent acceptance of who we were and allowed us to be who we needed to be. And that could happen in music. It could happen in any innumerable kinds of ways. But there was a quietness about it that did not try to explain away what happened. And it was a gift for which I will be forever grateful. So that brings us to within the church community. If you are having members that you know are grieving, and you know the mention, for example, of jobs, and given our economic situation, this is so hurting in our society for so many people. There has to be a way that we can still show that we are aware that there is a new hurt in people's lives. And whether, again, it's a handshake, whether it's an invitation, and that could bring us into another subject area, of what society does with those who suddenly become odd numbers, and that happens in the church. If you look at your church and see how many single people there are, that's a good indication of what your community is like. Because to be a 3 and a 5, or a 1, even at Holden, is an interesting experience. And it's a challenge for any church community to be inclusive. So, anybody have any ideas? Anything worked? But you see, we who are grieving, if our church has been important, we do have an expectation of being included. We want desperately to be included, some way, somehow. And we don't know how, because the path was already there for us before, whoever we were. But now we're new, and we don't fit. And if there's one place we want at least something to fit, it's a church. And that includes the expectation we have of who our pastor is and that role to us who are grieving for whatever that may be. And we can't be all things to all people, so depending on what kind of relationship you've had, that of course is going to be very much determined on what continues. If you have any comments, now I'm in a big church of maybe 2,000. And it's not the church's fault, it's my church, my fault as much. But I'm in a new community, I'm in a big church, it's very hard to feel a sense of community. But I have my barriers up because that's part of my survival. For the first year after my husband's death, the inside of my mouth would get raw from chewing on it because I would try to keep control because I was in a situation where it was not permissive for me, like it was in North Carolina. I could get up, I could walk out, or if I felt like just letting the tears flow, it was okay. But now I'm in a situation that's very difficult. I don't know people, I feel very strange, and it was expected upon me by other people in my family to go to church. Now, if I had my druthers, I'd have just stayed home. Because there's sometimes, you know, it's like watching a bad TV show. At least you can turn it off, right? And I'm a firm believer, if you've got options, you take them if you're grieving. If you know something's going to really hurt you, why put yourself through it? And if you know church sometime is going to be so hard, then, you know, why go, right? So, you know, I chewed the inside of my mouth. It got raw. It was really very, very, very painful there for a while. But if anybody has any suggestions, either to what has worked in your situation or things that your pastor may have done beyond the first week,
keep busy. My pastor had a, at the time I thought he was pushing me around too, but after a while I realized that he just kept me so busy that, and I thought, what is he doing? He knew what he was doing.
How did he keep you busy?
Well, he just started at that time, he started a program called Respite. Are you familiar with it?
No.
We have it at home in several churches. It's for if you have an older parent or someone that you know that is tied down with someone and can't get away from them, they can bring them to our church 2 days a week. It's not church related. They can bring them on, started at our church, and now it has the mushroom. Quite a bit. How many churches now?
11.
11 churches, and it started just when my husband had died. And so I had been married 43 years, so I was pretty much at a loss. And he just got me in there and just got me going on it. And I didn't have time to think too much, you know. I thought in my own way, yes, but I didn't.
Someone in the
back?
Yeah, Catholic churches sponsor something, not individual parishes, I don't mean that, but like a diocese might sponsor something called Beginning Experience for people who are widowed, divorced, or separated. And there was one available in my community, which I've taken advantage of, and that can be very helpful for people. And it's not limited to Catholics. Anybody can take advantage of it.
I would also venture to say include your friends because they want to help, and a lot of times they are just open arms, and they are open arms, and unless you let them know you're in need, they're not going to know how much you need to help.
One thing my mother has shared with me is she and my father used to share friendships with other couples, and now she ends up in a situation where she goes out with only women and only widows. And I think it's very important to keep those friends if you can, you know.
And a lot of that responsibility lies with the friends, because my mom finds herself in the same position. It's a little bit different in that she's the pastor's wife, and she's kind of sitting there now in the same church, but an entirely new church, and she's a threat to the new people there, of course, too. Our whole family is. They've welcomed us, which is what they basically had to do, not formally, but they've welcomed us back into our new position. But she's been fortunate in that she was known by everyone in the church then, of course, and many of them have kept up those ties and tried to include her, to call her up to do some things. But at the same time, a lot of them have dropped because it's not as natural, or it'll be, you know, out of that couple, the husband will do something else, and so it'll be just her and the social, you know, end up being the two of them going out and seeing a movie or something like that. Like, they've done a good thing for a while. You know, I get that feeling. I don't know, I'm not there, but I get that feeling. And I also hear her saying often, there's one other older lady in town finds herself a widow, and they really do delight in each other's company sometimes. And but at the same time, my mom doesn't want to be just considered a widow all the time. And then, you know, that's all she is, and her only friends are those same types, you know. For couples to not feel awkward in a threesome or something, you know, to go ahead and take them all and do whatever you need to do, not differently, just because she's a mother.
In our church, we have two or three groups of people that get together for potluck dinner and then go to play a musical or a concert, And we have, I think all these groups are kind of mixed that there. Some couples and some singles, maybe widows, possibly divorced, and some younger and some older, and they feel it's really a good mix, and I'd like to keep that up and recommend it.
There's one other...
Okay, coming back to your particular questionnaire where you mentioned coming into a new church and there's thousands of people in the church itself. Isn't it, I mean, I haven't had this experience, but it strikes me, isn't it possible that you have to make the first move yourself, that you've got to become acquainted with people and let them know what your situation is before they can respond?
Yes, if you're new. You see, if you are in grief, you have silent screams. There is nothing in you in real grief that gives you any energy to tell someone else what you need. And that varies for everybody. I don't care what the grief is. And those are silent cries. And it's only those who really know you well. That's why if you're in a new situation, it's very difficult. And that's why I say I've put my own walls up. I do not blame those in this new community. That is much mine. But at the same time, there has, and that will change, and it is beginning to. It will be very slow. But that is something for you to realize. I mean, if you say to someone, let me know when I can help you, how many of you have ever said that, and how many times have they ever called you? You are the one that has to be creative, and you're going to have to dare to stretch out. And it's there are times when it's just impossible for the person who's hurting. And I don't know, it's amazing what masks we put on, you know. We think we're hurting so inside that surely it's got to scream to the world. And yet everybody walks by you, you know, and one of the first things you say, oh, you look terrific. You are really looking good today. How many times have you said that to someone who's grieving? They must look terrible, you know? I mean, you know, you just come out of the house and you're just agonized. And I don't know anything about the psychology of that, but I'm assuming that that person is telling me I look good so they don't have to deal with why I don't look good, you know? So it's sort of like, you know, how are you doing? And don't tell me, just say fine. Yeah.
I've been told that there are a certain number of stages of grief that each person must pass through in order to handle it. Can you speak to that? Seven stages or something?
Well...
I can't.
Yeah.
It was really interesting that I had been informed about those two on Death and Dying, Kubler Ross's book on that, and I read it after the fact. But I hesitate whenever you make the stages because not everyone can hit all the stages and no one's going to do in the same order or anything like that. But I give her a lot of credit, and I think there's a lot there. She's studied many cases like that, and in my case, it was when I look back now and think back to that day and a half spent at his bedside talking with him and to him. Yeah, he went through all of those. The denial, I remember him laying there, you know, and the bargaining and going through all of them. The anger stage, you know, when he's shaking his fist and each one of them came. The separation stage where he wanted all of us to leave the room but not to leave the hospital. He wanted, you know, to go through some of this by himself, and then finally to the acceptance stage. I'm over here just brimming with all these things that I feel like saying. That I wish you all could have been here in January. I was here, and you know, I say I like to talk about this, and I really do. And in January, I was able to give a Vespers up here on the topic and ramble about all these things. And that was one of my main points too. It was such a strength for me to see my dad get to the acceptance stage when he was at peace, and he was laying there asking my sister if she'd sing at the funeral and things like this. And it was such an incredible strengthening for me. And I just wanted to add to, while I got the floor, the whole thing, you know, you said hymns, that, oh boy, that's such a, I give anything for being in a church setting and to be singing one of those hymns, sitting next to someone you know, who knows you're thinking about that and you just grab your knee or something like that. It can be incredible. a mighty fortress. I talked about at this Vesper service about a piece that I played in the band at St. Olaf, and they dedicated it to the memory of my dad. It was right after the funeral. I went back and played in the concert with him. And it's called Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. It's written with Dylan Thomas's poem in mind, which talks about raging at death, yet rejoicing in life and what we can do with that. And a mighty fortress is played by a tremendous brass section in the middle of that, with all kinds of clashing things going on around it. And we played it again this year. I was lucky enough to be president of the band, and we got to do a chapel service, and I talked in between, and we played Do Not Go Gentle. This was the spring when I got back, and it was one of the most powerful things I've ever been through. It was just so great. I don't know why I wanted it.
My husband has lost his health. His neck is falling apart. I'm sure you've kind of noticed that he sits around the pillow and the brace. And you know, I think one thing that kind of surprises me is the number of people that, you know, seem to feel that if you've got faith and a good doctor, you are, you know, guaranteed health. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, wonder what you think about that.
Yes. We didn't talk about our expectation of God. And do you have a God who gives you an insurance policy and then fails you when things don't go well? And do you look at people for whom health, job, marriage, child, spouse, loss is something that has occurred because something is wrong in something you've done? And that's a heavy, not a very good one to end on. But we get lots of subliminal messages that way, right? Right.
I have a friend whose husband has cancer of the liver right now, and she has three little children. And as I have got close to that situation, I picked up a book that I had earlier heard about, When Bad Things Happen to Good mm-hmm. People, by a Jewish rabbi yep. whose son had the illness where they aged very rapidly, and he died at the age 13. It was diagnosed when he was 2 years old. The book, for me, as an outsider of that situation, helped me a great deal to come to terms with my own faith and how I feel about bad things happening to good people. I did give her the book, and as I discussed with another friend who had gone through a cancer scare in her own family, someone had given her the book, and she hated it. And she disliked it because it didn't have, she wanted a Christian element in it. For me, I could take, with my own faith, it one step further for what it, you know, did not have, a Christian element. You know, because he has the same foundation, obviously, as we do with the Jewish faith. So I found that helpful.
Yes. I think one point in that book, and I think it's what you've been saying too, is how we can be or show God's love, or God's love is through the people around you. I think it made that point, and mm-hmm. that reaching out. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's no. what we can do. Yeah.
That's all it's about. Doris Edmond had a session on abuse and discipline, told the story about a little character she got that she clearly loved to learning. And I think that's the message that God gives us. And, you know, we translate God's love in all situations. And if there is brokenness, the message of the cross is that we're a love to healing. And if that's a message to us, to do the same, however you find your way. But it means, like anything else, if it's important enough to you, you're going to risk it. If you are worried about whether you say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, just go ahead, because we'll love it. If all you're doing is loving us, that will come through no matter what your intent. And one thing we have not touched, and that is children. And children grieve. they grieve greatly. And Lord knows we've got lots of grieving children for many, many reasons in our society. And we don't pay a lot of attention to that. It'd be another whole subject. But they need lots of loving, because their world gets turned upside down and inside out. If they lose a father, if a job goes, and their world is supposed to be in some kind of a framework, at least at that point in life it's supposed to be. That's an expectation that they should, you know, we all would like to have as a given. So whoever we are in children's lives, whether we're a parent or a teacher or a neighbor, we need to love them a lot, because they do hurt and are so fragile, and there's so much left in them that's growing. And it's going to be very important what we do to help that growth.
But what can you do? I mean, to love them, but, I mean, can we be more concrete? I mean, can you give a better example?
Yeah.
Just to say?
My son, my youngest son is 12. He was 6 when his brother was killed. 2 weeks later, his oldest brother went to St. Olaf. We lived in North Carolina. And he went to school. The first thing the teacher does, first day of school, is tell us what you did this summer. Right? That's almost the first thing the teacher asks, or write a story about your family. And that happened religiously until we left North Carolina. Every year, Kurt would go to school, he would have to go through that. And so in the first year, it was hard for me because I was not able to articulate what was going on. But it wasn't too long into that year of school, I went to the teacher. And as a parent, not everybody's going to do that, or a teacher's not going to always be aware of what's going on. But if there is a teacher that knows, hopefully you're going to give some latitude and some understanding to a child who pulls himself apart, as mine did, who would simply go away because solitude and loneliness was a new happening in his life, and tears were not acceptable by peers, and they would come to him like they did to me in the most unacceptable times, didn't know what to do with them. And you know, what do other kids say? You know, you're a sissy, what are you crying about?
So to just allow the child to be alone without...
Well, the teacher was aware.
Uh-huh.
And whatever the situation is with the child, if you are aware as a teacher, whatever your situation is, a bit about the child's background, what's brought them to behave in the manner they are behaving, that gives you some antennas as to how to respond. Okay, we were new in Northfield, Minnesota. My daughter was a senior in high school. I can tell you one thing you could do that didn't happen. We were new in this church. Not one teenager from that church made any kind of motion her age. Okay, until about, my husband died in October. I don't know, April. Now there's leadership in the church with youth. From my perspective as a very objective parent, you know, when we're most susceptible with our children. But I would have ached for that person in that leadership position to have said to someone or a parent who would have been aware, there has to be a very lonely young woman. She's new. She cannot have a good friend that she can talk to. There is a network, and we need to play with it. Those of us who are in leadership positions, if you are a pastor, if you are a teacher, if you know someone, there are things you can do. You may not do it directly, but you can find someone else, for sure, who can be the link.
Speaking from a teacher's point of view, I teach third grade, and it is real important for parents to let the teachers and let whoever, like the school, know, because a lot of times kids do act differently, and how are we to know what's going on? And it is really, really important so that we can help the kids and help the situation in the classroom, help the other kids be aware of what's going on, so that, you know, kids can be really mean, but if they understand what's going on, they can really help out and support the other kids too. So, you know, it's really important for parents to, you know, inform the school and inform the teachers especially, because we can do a lot to help the kids.
Mm-hmm.
had a real awkward situation. I teach, and I know that I knew that there was a student that I had in class that had a father that had committed suicide. And real awkward situation came up. There was another kid in the book reading a book on suicide, and they were joking about it and laughing about it. And this kid was real quiet and liked to study. And they just started, you know, teasing him kind of, and they didn't mean it. They liked this kid, and I knew that they did, and they didn't mean to hurt him in any way, but they'd say, "What's wrong with you? You look like you could commit suicide." And I was, you know, I thought, oh, how do I handle this? Because I can't make a big issue of this, because obviously the kid wanted to just live his life and not, you know, the other kids didn't know that about it. So, well, it didn't go on long, but it did happen. It got said, and I just, after class, I just talked to this boy, and I said, "I don't know if you realize this, but this is, I don't think you probably know this, because I don't think you'd be saying that," but then I told him that Will's father had committed suicide, and this was a really tough mean kid, and he really did feel bad about it. I never prevented that from happening to Will. He had to hear that, but I guess I had hoped that, you know, maybe he, it never happened again, and hopefully those kids never brought it up again. Maybe just in knowing that was enough. I was unable to prevent that hurt. Yeah. But so there's some different awkward situations, I guess.
Yeah.
It really helped me to read that book by Now, Not a Solitude, where he talks about the meaning of the word care, mm-hmm. just to be present with, not advice or solutions, but just to be there.
They're
reading that a lot.
Yeah, not curing.
Right, not curing.
Not curing, just
curing. And he talks about, you know, Kierkegaard and Sartre having no solutions, no advice, mm-hmm. just sharing their own pain, their own experience, identifying with somebody else, trying to as much as they can before they're.
What's the name of that book?
Out of Solitude by Now.
Nowen.
Tremendous. 60 page.
It was used for for matins the other morning.
Yeah. Excellent book. Mm-hmm.
A question. In the case of children suffering loss and your friends, and your children are their friends, is it important to maintain continuity? I mean, for example, if those children come over to your house on Saturday afternoon regularly, or you go do something with them, or they stay overnight, and now they're in this situation, Is it a good response to keep on doing what you've been doing? and not denying it's happening, not acting as if nothing has gone on. But you said that their world is torn inside out. Is it?
Yes.
I would trust it's a good response when I'm checking it out.
Right, because that's a structure that's predictable.
Yeah.
And that's showing that they still fit with you. And hopefully the child still has one or two slots that he's still okay in. Because in his family, you see, he's not. Whatever is going on in the family, it is not okay. And one of the worst things for children, clearly there's been just a very few studies on it, is what happens to siblings when a sibling dies. Because it's a very different interaction than what happens when a parent dies, for example. Because the parents are absolutely turned upside down. If there is a loss, say, of my mother, clearly my husband wouldn't have grieved the same way I do, so that there's going to be some unevenness in the grief process. But when a child is lost, the parents are so devastated that the other children are looking at what was a certain kind of security and stability, and it's wiped out. So not only are they trying to figure out not only whatever relationship they had with that sibling and what that means because it's not present, but then they also have to deal with whatever's going on with that parent and the parents. And then we haven't even talked about either what happens to a marriage relationship. I'm sure you hear a lot about, especially when a child dies. The percentage is incredible for divorce rate. And it's just an incredible stress on a marriage. Because the unevenness of grief, there is no one to support you. And you cannot look to your children and you most certainly find it difficult most times to look to your spouse. So there's different kinds of anger and stages that occur with that. I don't know what they are, but I know that they are there. And so that you have, depending on whatever the circumstance is, a whole new ballpark. And it's pretty scary.
And an outlet for that is marriage counseling or seeing someone, and our society has a thing called, oh yeah, I think she's seeing someone about it.
Yeah, she's not very strong, and her faith was somebody too great, right?
Some very, very small children seem to really feel lost. Suddenly I was thinking of two little tykes that were in this, and one three-room patient room we have in this hospital. And these youngsters had been together for, I think it was the best part of a year. And parents weren't able to come too often because they were out of town. But at one point, the one mother came to room in with her little one. So they took little Brendan out of the room, put him in just the very next room, but of course the door is shut, and she slept in, and she was to learn his care. And it left little Tommy in the other room alone. And we came in to see him Sunday afternoon, and he sat in the playpen. He didn't want to play. He wasn't tired. He wasn't hungry. He wasn't anything else. But he was sitting there just grieving, really. It was so obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about expectations on you as how to grieve, like with the different stages? I know a friend whose father died, and his mother told him he was not grieving correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are a lot of people for whom that's, you know, you do not, as a grieving person, you are really out of whack for a lot of people. And especially within the church, and that's why you've got a lot of angry people in church, or who leave, because you have lots of people who expect, because of your religious premise, basic faith, whatever, that you should behave in some certain way, and that they have an agenda for you that says, at this stage, you should be done. That's one of the problems with it, with how, while society's responded to what Kubler-Ross has written, is because they're saying, well, now you got to the anger stage, now you should get to the acceptance stage, and at least after a year, you know, you should be all through this stuff, right? Or if you're just inconsolable or whatever, you know, that you don't really do it in the way that's fashionable or whatever. I don't know if there's a fashionable way, but I guess mostly that's keeping it to yourself.
Sure, right. Yeah.
Oh, he's responding.
Yeah. So, yes, and for men, it's very difficult. That's right.
In some ways, you know, it's difficult because we're not supposed to be able to find things like that, but then in the same way, My feeling has been that the other way, my brother kept thinking that I should go talk with my pastor or something at that school and experience it the same way that he does, and I'm not that way.
That's right.
And I in my subjective position, don't feel like I haven't grieved. Mm-hmm. You just really can't have those expectations.
There's a young woman who is doing a dissertation on grief within families where children had died. And my husband and I belonged to a support group. It was a very loose group. It wasn't a compassionate friends. I mean, there are many national groups. And so she came and asked us if we would be willing to talk. And it was not easy to say yes, because that opens it all up. But we, most of us within that group, agreed to do that with her separately. So she came to our homes, and she asked us very specifically about our children. And it was interesting, her perception then and her observations of what we said about our children. Because clearly we were getting a lot of support from our kids, but they weren't verbalizing it. Now, we were very concerned because they weren't talking. And it was really bothersome. But I hadn't read any books on what children do when they grieve, you know. I mean, we're not ready for that, right? It's another path that we're not charting for. And what she told us, and maybe you would agree with that from your knowledge in counseling, but it is very common for young people, teenagers particularly, to not verbalize, more common than to verbalize. But they're very nonverbal in their communication in other ways. And so I learned a lot that helped in the process of us perhaps helping her. There were expectations on my son when he went to St. Olaf. You know, everybody was thinking he should really talk, you know. Yeah, I roomed with his cousin. Why doesn't he talk? He didn't want to talk.
The kids act out pretty cool. A lot of them on the athletic field. They're
sure
angry, they're rage.
Sure.
Little kids in the playpen, you know, they can't talk, so
sure.
They act it out.
Yeah. It's not everybody's way to do, but especially there's some, that time frame. You know, teenagers find it extremely difficult. There's very few people. My son found one young woman at St. Olaf to talk to. And she sought him out because she had heard about him, and she had a very good friend, had a loss of a good friend who was a young person. And somehow they clicked. She was the one person he could really feel comfortable with.
Okay.